Good evening. Well, I thank you for coming out. Who comes out on a day like this to sit inside and hear about a weird topic from somebody you don't know? Hopefully, I will make this worth your while. What's interesting is this right here is what I was aiming at for 6 years. I got a PhD in theological ethics at the University of Aberdeen. My defense, after I'd passed, both the internal and external examiner were very excited to hear how I was going to put the work that I had done to use. And I got some suggestions on where I should apply for open professorships. I got at least three ideas for books I should write. And they were very excited to hear exactly what I was going to do with my life. And I said, oh, I appreciate those suggestions. I'm not going to do any of that. I said, well, what are you going to do? I said, oh, I'm going to go back to training preachers. And then I'm also going to, hopefully, if I ever get the opportunity, talk at churches and help pastors think through some of the most complicated issues related to sex and technology. At which point, the external examiner, who's kind of a personal hero of mine, very sincerely said, why would you do that? To which I responded, because people like you ask questions like that. I thought it was funny. He did not. It's true. I spent 6 years of my life thinking about, which we'll touch on tonight, why humans want to and why humans probably shouldn't have sex with robots. Now, you're probably thinking, this is a joke. It is not a joke. And as easy as it would be to simply go, oh, yeah, I'm out. I'm already out. I just ask for a few minutes of your time. I'm not going to lie to you. We're going to go on kind of a wild ride tonight. Hopefully you'll laugh. You might cry. At some point, it's possible you'll feel sick to your stomach. The hope, though, is that you actually, either for the first time or in an increasing way, see the beauty and relevance of theology, Christianity, by having to think about things that maybe you don't want to think about, maybe you've never thought about, but are surrounded by all the time. So, not only do I hope that you're more intrigued by and fascinated by the Christian religion by the time that we're done, but also by the very complicated fact that you live in a body that is currently dying. This is the weird thing about being in a room of other human beings. Somebody in this room will be the first one to die. And somebody in this room will be the last one to die. And maybe the most interesting thing is, whoever those people are is probably going to surprise us. You don't have to point fingers or take bets or say it's me. But let's be honest, like, living in finite human bodies is complicated. Turn 43 this year. In my 43rd year of life, I've developed psoriasis, which is awesome. I have torn my rotator cuff, and I just don't sleep very well in general. I am dying at an astounding rate presently, and you are too. So, here's the hope, that we'll walk away from here convinced that being embodied, finite, mortal creatures is complicated, but beautiful, and dedicated to living as well as we can with whatever time we've got left. To help us along our way, I'll, of course, be using the musical artist Lady Gaga. 2011, Lady Gaga went from being a dance club underground sensation to a worldwide phenomenon with the release of her album Born This Way. The title track of that song, which I will not sing for you, is quite something. She says, "I'm beautiful in my way because God makes no mistakes. I'm on the right track, baby. I was born this way. Don't hide yourself in regret. Just love yourself and you're set." Well, let's be honest. I don't know if you're a Lady Gaga fan, but she's on to something, isn't she? I mean, shoot, let's be honest. Lady Gaga, at least so far, agrees with our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. God doesn't make any mistakes. You were born as you were born. You should not hide yourself in regret. And you should love yourself. In fact, Jesus assumes as much. I mean, how else are you supposed to love your neighbor? Because the call from Jesus is to love your neighbor as yourself. The assumption of the fully God and fully man Savior of the world, Jesus Christ, is that you love yourself. Of course, Gaga will go on to say more. Don't be a drag, just be a queen. Whether you're broke or evergreen, whether you're black, white, beige, cholo descent, you're Lebanese, or I don't know how she got away with this one, Orient. 2011 was a different time. Whether life's disabilities left you outcast, bullied, or teased, rejoice and love yourself today because, baby, you were born this way. No matter gay, straight, or bi, lesbian, transgendered life, I'm on the right track, baby. I was born to survive. Now, to Gaga's credit, she makes herself clear, something she had every intention of doing, something most artists have every intention of doing with the music they produce. She longed to have her music be understood, not only understood, but beloved, and clearly it has been. Just last year, her song, Born This Way, was awarded, and I quote, "the most inspirational LGBT song of all time" by Rolling Stone. What are Christians to do with a song like this? It's complicated for at least two reasons. Number one, she is touching on profound, true truths. And yet, number two, these truths seem to go in all kinds of directions. Some helpful, others not so much. What do we do with being born this way, in human flesh, with one life to live, a life that is far more complicated than we would often like to admit? Like, we won't have testimony time, but just I'd like you to think about it for a minute. I want you to be honest with yourself. What are the two things about yourself that you don't like? Not about, like, that you get too upset when the Phillies are getting absolutely destroyed by the Colorado Rockies, which they are right now. Thank goodness. I don't mean those internal things. I mean your body. What do you wish you could change? What's interesting is, for most of us, it's hard to think about just two because there's so many. And the other interesting part is if we matched all of the lists up, they'd probably be pretty different. And what's maybe most interesting is what's on your list would make no sense to me, and what's on my list would make little sense to you. But it's complicated. So let's face the dragon of being born this way in our time and place, because things have rarely, if ever, been as challenging as they are today. Here's the problem. You and I live in a rather complicated universe. I don't just mean being finite, but you and I live in, and I will explain this phrase, a technologically laden, persuasive, consumeristic universe oriented towards a graspable utopia. That was my big fancy phrase. I paid lots of money so I could say that in public. What does all this mean? Well, okay, first of all, we live in a technologically laden society. Devices are all around us. Devices are on us. And in some of our cases, devices are inside of us. I don't just mean like in some kind of conspiratorial way. I just mean like, you know, a pacemaker. Like, just think about this question. How many human servants would it take to replace all that tech does for you on a daily basis? Hundreds at minimum. Like, let's just get real basic. Like, just think about the amount of water you use and how easy it is to access on a daily basis. Just how many servants would that take? Like a solid 7 for some of you who love hot showers. Like 12, like my daughter. She'd probably, let's be honest, she'd probably need 50. It's a huge blessing. But it's also a real challenge to have all of the technology that we have around us. It's not only a technologically laden society, but it's also a persuasive consumeristic universe. Worth, happiness, status, and belonging in our world, at least we're told, comes on the basis of what we can buy or what we can aspire to buy. Also, in this persuasive consumeristic universe, you can change at whim. Let me give you an example. Anybody ever seen an ad for a car? What do car ads sell? They don't sell cars. What they sell is adventure, luxury, peace, status. Like, some of you are car people. I don't understand you people. It's fine. But like, that car you really want, why do you want it? Is your car really that bad? Of course it's not. It's not just that like a new car wouldn't be, my car is a piece of garbage. I'd love to have a new car. So if any of you want to give me a car after this, I'll gladly receive it. It's that weird thing where you get like wrapped up in cars. You ever do this? You don't have to raise your hand. I mean, I know we're amongst friends, but like, we won't get awkward. But you ever like go on the website and like customize the package for a car that you're never going to buy? And then you fantasize about what you're going to do with that car. And then you get upset about the life that you have because you don't have that car. And then you realize, like, 3 days later, like, this is the dumbest thing in the world. I don't need that car. Because here's the thing. I'm never going to be driving on the Autobahn. I don't even know how to spell Autobahn. And I think it's in Germany, but I'm not sure. What's the next thing you want to buy? And how bad do you want it? And why do you want it? We live in this universe that doesn't only tell us that our worth is on the basis of what we buy, and the club that we're in is on the basis of what we buy, but that we should always perpetually change and just get, not a lot, just that next thing. The weird thing is, you and I have bought into this lie 10,000 times. It's never worked. But the most persuasive thing about consumerism is that it convinces us that it's just one more thing, and that the solution to the problem of that thing not working is one more thing. The problem that it creates is also the problem that it can fix. We live in a technologically laden, persuasive, consumeristic universe. The third is oriented toward a supposedly graspable utopia. Now, I want to be clear. By utopia, I mean a yet-to-exist world that has all that we desire and none of what we don't. The ideal world. Oftentimes, we use the word utopia disparagingly. But I agree with those who see it as a vital part of human thought. For we do not have the world that we all want. And we all want something else really bad. What consumerism persuades us of is that we can almost touch it if we just get the next thing. The evil of consumerism is that it's always just around the next corner. It's almost graspable, but the fault is our own. It's essentially a secular version of the prosperity gospel. If you're not happy, if you're not fulfilled, that's your fault. It's fine, though. We can help you out with that. I know you thought this thing was going to be the thing, but it's not the thing. The next thing is the thing, I promise. Just one more thing. It's never worked, but maybe that's because you just haven't tried hard enough or bought the right combo of stuff. Living in this kind of universe causes us to question all kinds of things. Let me just give you one example. This universe that's technologically laden, persuading us to buy something else, and if we buy the right thing, we can just reach out and touch it, then here's a question that humans have rarely had to ask. What does it mean to be human if machines have human-like capabilities minus human frailties? Now, to be clear, machines have their own frailties, but they're different, and we're convinced that they are lesser problems. They're fixable problems. They're upgradable problems, and they're replaceable problems. Like, let's be honest. Is there any goodness in life as we know it? Wouldn't it be better if we were not what we are? I mean, here's the thing. Maybe we are born this way, but what if there's something we could do about the problems we experience in this life? What if we could experiment with life on another level? See, humans are fine and everything, but machines are better. Humans get soft, sick, stubborn, and then we die. What does it mean to be a Christian in a technological world? And what does it look like to help others live well, both believers and unbelievers alike? Why is this like a real live debate? Well, it's all wrapped up in the subtitle of my talk tonight. It's actually the outline for the talk. 3 points. The promise of transhumanism, the peril of transhumanism, and the difference that Christianity makes. And I want you to take all three of those incredibly seriously. Let's talk about the promise of transhumanism. Let's start with this. What in the heck is transhumanism? Just real quick, audience participation. If you Googled, Binged, or whatever the heck else like server you use to search things, if you searched the word transhumanism between the time you first saw that I was talking about this and today, before you got here, raise your hand. That's fine. There's no shame in it. Great. Yeah. This is not something, like if you're like, no, I use this term all the time, I'd be like, well, okay, so you're a liar. Right? What the heck is transhumanism? It's as simple as this. Transhumanism is a term coined by Julian Huxley in the 1960s to name the conviction that's been around for a very long time, and here it is, that humans can and should transcend the current state of human nature. That humans can and should transcend what we might call mortal, embodied human life. Two academics give a further definition that I think is helpful. They say transhumanism anticipates the application of science and technology to the amelioration or the removal, that's just a fancy word, the fixing of, removal of the bad and keeping of the good, of the human condition through genetic engineering, robotics, informatics, and nanotechnology. You don't need to know what any of those words mean. It's as simple as this. It's using science and technology to fix what's wrong with us, to fix the parts of us that just don't seem to work real good. This might sound like science fiction, but many are working towards this reality. And you already know it, whether you know it or not. But you might be thinking, okay, well, here's the thing, like, I'm not a transhumanist, so why should I care? Well, it's because of the way that transhumanism fits into our consumeristic utopian world. It persuades us to pursue a life other than the one we have at any cost necessary. And it does so by persuading you that the life you live is pretty subpar. Let me give you a very small example of this. Oil of Olay. Okay? Got anybody in the house that moisturizes? Anybody know the tagline of Oil of Olay? It's fine if not. Right? There's some guy in here who's like, I know, but I'm not going to say. Here it is. Love the skin you're in. It's true, right? Like, shoot, that's kind of like what Jesus was saying. Love the skin you're in. You go, what's wrong with that? Well, in one sense, on the face of it, nothing is wrong with the phrase. The problem is that they don't actually want you to just love the skin you're in. They want you to buy their product, which is why it's the tagline for a multinational corporation. Because the subtext is very simple. This is not some kind of weird conspiracy theory. It's very simple. If you do love the skin you're in, you'll buy our product. And if you don't buy our product, how could you possibly claim to love the skin that you're in? It's very simple, though. We'll help you out. Love the skin you're in. Buy our moisturizer. It's great. Now, this is not like an ad against Oil of Olay or whatever. You guys should just moisturize, right? getting older for some reason, like the moisture in certain parts of my body goes to other parts of my body. I don't understand this. I have to apply lotion all day long. Lotion is great. Lotion is a gift from God. And if you're like, I don't know what you're talking about, just wait for it. You'll get older. But you notice how incessant the sales pitch is? It's real simple. We'll help you out. Just love the skin you're in. Just buy what we got. It's a small taste of what we're talking about. Persuades us to pursue a life, this transhumanist stuff, a life other than the one we have at any cost necessary. And while it might be easy to laugh this kind of stuff off, we need to take it seriously, not only out of love for neighbor, but because the transhumanists are not totally wrong. So what are they arguing for? I think you can categorize the arguments for transhumanism in two broad categories. The first one is, you and I are obligated to pursue a safe world without limits. A safe world without limits. Here's the argument. Humanity's greatest problem is sickness and death. In other words, our greatest human problem is our finite frame. Worse, you and I are irrationally addicted to the idea of bodies. Example, we care for individuals, robbing resources from humanity's deserved and desired future. It's as simple as this. Why on earth should you and I feed starving children in Africa? That right there is a waste of time. Because it's costly, it's inefficient, and let's be honest, those people are just miserable lives and die. So what you and I need is quit feeling bad about people who get sick and die, let them die, and we'll use all of that resource material to figure out how to get to a stage where humanity no longer gets sick and dies. But unfortunately, the problem is we're addicted to the idea that this matters, this kind of, as some people put it, this like meat puppet suit that we have. We just can't get over the intellectual hurdle of just freeing ourselves from all of this. Those, at least, who are honest in this camp admit that the cost is huge, at least psychologically, of leaving people, sick and dying people, to get sick and die, but we can and must get beyond our bodies for the sake of humanity. Only then will we be safe and limitless. You might ask the question, well, what does it mean to be safe and limitless? And the answer of the transhumanist is like, I don't know, but it's better than this. And actually, we can't possibly know. You can't put that burden on us to say what we would be because we haven't been there yet. But it's going to be great. We just got to do it. Come with us. And if not, you don't love humanity. Okay. So how does that sex robot thing play into all of this? First, terminology. What's a sex robot? I'm going to give you the complicated definition. Ready? It's a robot you can have sex with. That's what it is. It can be as simple or as complicated as you can possibly imagine. What does that have to do with all of this? Here's what it has to do with. By using these machines, we can begin to get over our psychological limitations to finite human bodies because those bodies are whatever we want them to be. And we own them. We own them! And they're never going to go away, and they're never going to die, and they're never going to get sick. We can just swap out parts and everything. We can, in essence, experiment with our future selves. And by doing so, not only will we be marginally happier in the here and now, but we'll be getting used to what we're one day going to become. And you might not like it, but it's coming down the pike, so you better just get on board, is the kind of argument that the transhumanists use. We'll be safe in a world without limits. There's another argument. It's not only that we'll be safe in a world without limits, but we'll also have a fair world without limits. Now, I love your pastor, Raymond Johnson, with everything that's within me. However, Raymond Johnson can't dunk. And I know that Raymond would love to dunk. And I'll bet you at least once, Raymond was like, "It's not fair that I can't dunk." It's easy to laugh at Raymond. Let's be all honest, we all should laugh at Raymond more. There's things that you think are unfair about the body you've been given too. Maybe it's not dunking, maybe it's the fact that you've got cancer. Maybe it's the fact that you have a mental illness. Maybe it's the fact that just other people are naturally happier than you are, smarter than you are, taller than you are, shorter than you are, skinnier than you are, whatever. Isn't it unfair? So the argument goes, let's use technology to level the playing field. We've got it. So why don't we just use it to make everything fair? I mean, sure, this would be a fundamental change, not only to humans, but to humanity. But it's a moral obligation. Some even would argue that states, nations should obligate their parents, the parents, to improve by any means necessary the lives of their children. And if they don't, they should have those children taken away and those children should be exterminated. Now, again, you might be thinking, like, there's no way this could be real. Do you know how many children with Down syndrome are born in Iceland? Zero. They've cured it! And you go like, well, that's just, you know, that's never coming here. Buckle up. Could. Thankfully it hasn't, and I hope it never does. But here's the thing, like, if they figure out that your child is particularly prone to this, that, or the other thing, that's a burden on society, then it's real simple. We have this treatment. You can either have the treatment or you can kill your child, but, you know, you pick. And by the way, do the treatment, because we really want you to have the treatment. We want you to have the child, because we want everything to be fair. It's persuasion with a gun to your head. But we're all about fairness, because it wouldn't be fair if your kid was shorter, slower than the rest. Now, of course, any of us that, you know, have at least a moment's pause go, doesn't that argument work in reverse? Like, we could also just make everybody dumber, shorter. But they go, well, here's the thing, though. Like, just get... We're not going to do that, because, of course, we all want to be great, so we wouldn't do that as humans. Just, let's get fair. Robots serve as a stepping stone towards fairness. Toward fairness. I've had the conversation with many people who are Christian, not married, and unhappy. It's not fair. It's not fair that you get to be married and I'm not married. Sometimes that's because of my proclivities. Sometimes that's just because I haven't found the right person. Sometimes it's because society has shaped the human imagination in a way that never finds somebody like me attractive. It's not fair. It's not fair. Enter the sex robots. It's one way to pursue fairness. Because, like, you know, it maybe won't solve everything, but at least orient us towards fairness. You don't have to use them, but your neighbor can, because, you know, we could all be fair. If you haven't figured it out yet, transhumanism is a profoundly religious movement. And it's a profoundly religious movement that Christians should profoundly understand. Not in order to combat and only combat, but to understand and in many ways sympathize with. Because living ain't easy. And life is unfair. And we're all going to die. And for most of us, it's not the dying that's hard. It's the getting towards death that's the problem. And it would be really nice if that stuff went away. So what's the problem? Well, transhumanism may be persuasive, but it's also perilous. So having talked about the promise of transhumanism, let's briefly survey the perils, which should be readily apparent, but, you know. We'll frame it under two questions. The first one is, do individuals matter? Because here's the thing, there's no guarantee that any of this stuff is going to work. One of the reasons why it's so profoundly religious is because it's a faith-based movement. I promise, things will be better in an idealized future. You just have to believe. And if you think, like, Christianity is blind faith, you ain't seen nothing. Because we don't know what this is going to do or how this is going to affect us, but just trust us, it's going to work. And you go, okay, but you don't actually know that. And we don't. There's no guarantee that any of this is going to work. And in the process of pursuing these things, we are giving up on the one thing that we've always known. It's one of the weird things about being human. You don't know, I don't know, nobody knows what it means to be human without a body. We just don't know. Maybe parts of our body. It's one of the weirdest things when you're a kid. When you have that conversation with the other kids on the playground, when it's like, okay, so if I chop my hand off and I have a kid, will the kid have two hands? And then you got the one kid who's like, no, I've seen it. And they're like, oh my gosh, really? And then you get all tripped out. You're like, hold on a second, they do have two hands. And then you go, if I get my hand cut off, am I still a person? You go, yes, what about my arm? Yes, what about both arms? Yes, what about both arms, both legs? You go, yes. And you go, how much of me is me? And then you just start to trip out, right? And then you're just like wandering around the baseball field being like, I don't even know what I am. Some of you right now are like, I need to find a baseball field. The weird thing about being human is we don't exactly know what it is, and yet we absolutely know what it is. And the only way we know what it is because of the bodies that we have. And our bodies are all different. And even those of us who have bodies that are incredibly limited, still only have the experience of what it means to be human in a body. And if we pursue the future of transhumanism, of disembodied humans, then we don't even know what that means. Individuals matter, friends, especially the vulnerable. And this isn't a Christian argument. There's lots of non-Christians who are making this argument. You should thank God for the people who have nothing to do with Jesus and who are just like, excuse me, yes, but real humans matter. Those are the people you come alongside and go like, yes, thank you, I agree with you. Why do you think humans matter? I know why humans matter. Let's have a conversation about why you think humans matter. We'll high five and go, humans matter. It's very simple. You cannot claim to care about the one, humanity, if you do not care about the many, humans. By the way, that's not just a critique of transhumanism. That is a word of exhortation for all the Christians in the room. You cannot claim to love your neighbor if you don't love your actual neighbors. Let's go back to starving children in Africa. Here's what's weird. According to scientific research, 90% of you, when I say starving children in Africa, can actually picture children who are starving somewhere. The weirdest part about the 90% of you is that those kids don't actually exist. For the vast majority of us, we've never been around actual starving children in Africa. Some of us have, and it is horrific. But we can all picture, what that kind of would be like. And some of us find it very easy to engage in what we call moral license. I'd like to help my neighbor who lives next to me, but to starving children in Africa, which don't actually exist. The ones I'm imagining just exist in fictitious space. Now, there are starving children in Africa. But when we use that, we go, I can't actually help this person. I mean, this jerk has a job and a car and everything, but them over there. You cannot claim to love humans if you don't love the people who love next to you. Christians of all people should understand that their neighbors are actually concrete, embodied human persons. Now, I really hope some of you have a deep and abiding desire to help starving children in Africa, which means that you'll actually support people who are amongst starving children in Africa, or you will go get on an airplane and go live your life serving starving children in Africa, in which case they will be your concrete, embodied neighbors, or you'll be helping those who are serving their concrete, embodied neighbors. But just because you help other people doesn't mean that your neighbors don't matter. The critique of the transhumanist is also a helpful reminder to us that we must love the many if we claim to love the one. I hope you love humanity, and I really hope you love humans. Because we can only understand what it means to be human in human bodies, then we should, the critics of transhumanism say, come to embrace what we actually are, even if what we actually are isn't all that we'd like it to be. We should essentially pursue contentment and take whatever we've been given with a solid dose of joy and resolution that this is what we've been given, so let's appreciate this. Yes, there are technological advances, and some of those might be beneficial, but advance is not necessarily progress. And the advances that we have create as many challenges as they do benefits. So let's do the best with what we've got. Let me give you one evidence of this. Some of you have been faced with the very real and challenging task of what we colloquially call pulling the plug. Maybe it was a grandparent and you weren't actually having to make that decision. Maybe you made the decision. Statistically, there's a good number of you in this room who will have to make that decision at some point in your life. The weird thing is, the only reason that decision is something you would have to make is because you are sitting in a comfortable, air-conditioned, and lit room. You're like, I don't understand. What are you talking about? If you don't have electricity, there's no plug to pull. So here's the question. Quick show of hands. Who in here desires to live a life without electricity? That's right, nobody. But by having electricity, serious advance in human culture, then we are then faced with all kinds of dilemmas, all the way down to now plugs sometimes need to get pulled. Advances don't necessarily equal progress. Advances are complicated things. Advances are things we can benefit from, but just know that it makes for a more complicated world. This is the perilous side. So yes, while we could do all kinds of things, maybe we shouldn't, because individuals matter. The second argument isn't only that individuals matter, but the question that they ask is, isn't diversity a good thing? Ironically, though transhumanists claim to be radically progressive and edgy, they actually happen to be the most conservative people of all. Why? Because nothing is allowed to change. Always youthful, always capable, always strong. No change. It's uniformity on another level. Now, of course, the dark side of this is that someone always has to pay so that you can play. Who will bear the cost of this imagined future of fairness? Well, mostly poor, mostly women. Cheap, dexterous labor, and easy research and test subjects. That's who's going to have to pay. The darkest irony is that the least and the last will be made to pay the costs for a future that does not include bodies like theirs. We'll use your labor to make a world where you no longer exist. And that's fairness. There's no place for the disabled, the elderly, or the poverty-ravaged bodies in an age of fairness. So in sum, talking about the peril of transhumanism, individuals should matter, and diversity should be protected. We should come to appreciate what we are and not simply what we can make ourselves. Only from a position of relative contentment can we work toward marginal human gains for welfare, but never at the expense of what we are. That sounds pretty good, right? And it is. Here's the problem. If that's all there is, then it seems to leave us in a rather awkward position. Longing for the utopian world of transhumanism, yet longing to love others and appreciate what we are in a present that is far less than utopian. The major problem for many transhumanist opponents is that they don't have a very strong foundation to argue from. Because while they strive to appreciate the present, they have no firm grasp on a future that might be worth waiting for. And it's at this point, friends, that we turn from the promise and the peril of transhumanism to the difference that Christianity makes. In the 4th century, there's a guy named Augustine, who, if you don't know him, you should. Top 5 Christian thinker, history of the world. Yes, I, of course, have a bias, considering he's the major research subject of my life, but anybody who's read him for more than 4 pages clearly is like, oh no, something is going on here. This guy is a heavy hitter. Augustine talked a lot about resurrection. What he says is, along with the transhumanists, you know what? The greatest problem in life is that we get sick and die. We're never actually happy in this life. By the way, this is like a pastoral point. This is free. This is just a sidebar. Ready? Okay, here you go. Here's a just a free point. Just want you to put this one in your back pocket and walk out of here with it. Ready? You will never be happy as long as you're alive. That is the most pastorally helpful thing I have to tell you right now. It doesn't mean you won't have experiences, momentary things of happiness. You're like, I'm sitting next to a beautiful person. I love this person very much. I am very happy. Or I just ate a Philly cheesesteak, or I'm going to go eat a Philly cheesesteak. I am going to be happy. You cannot tell me otherwise. I have been happy. I will be happy. I'm fine. That's fine. You know what the problem with the cheesesteak is? It all goes away. You know what one of the saddest moments is about eating a cheesesteak? The minute the cheesesteak is gone. And you're like, it is in me, and it is technically with me, but it is no longer with me. And then happiness, relative happiness, very quickly turns into sadness. Let's be honest, most of human life is pretty boring. There's some really dark days, punctuated with like glorious moments of just awesomeness, but most of it's just kind of normal. And if you can embrace the fact that you will never actually be truly, I mean, full on happy till you're dead, then you can actually live with relative happiness in this life. Please do not put the burden of eternity on today. It's a surefire way towards misery. For Augustine, happiness is very simple. It is having everything you've ever wanted and having it forever. Both of those conditions are necessary. Because if you have everything you want, then, of course, you will fight, kill, and destroy anybody or anything in order to protect that. Always fearful that it's going away. Remember the first time you got a $10 bill? And you were like, I'll fight the whole world. Nobody better take this $10. I can buy 7 candy bars. And you thought about it all the time. You're like, just burned a hole in your pocket, but you had your hand on it. You're walking all over the place like, I got $10. And you put $10 back and you just kept walking around. It was the happiest day, and it was also the most nerve-wracking day, because you were sure that if the bully found you, you were toast. So you got to be the bully, right? You're just like, I have the $10. And you're like, yeah, that was dumb when I was 7. It still happens, doesn't it? Your best days, you're like, I just do anything to keep today happening. I don't ever want this to go away. What do I have to do to not get this to go away? You got to have the thing forever. But imagine an eternity that wasn't as good as you hoped. That would be miserable. You need everything you've ever wanted. The ideal of whatever that thing is. And you need it forever. And Augustine goes, what else do you think that life with God in the new heavens and the new earth will be like? You'll have it all, and you'll have it forever. You'll even have the ideal human body. You might think, hold on a second, that sounds like transhumanism. And in many ways, it is just as utopian, but there is a major difference, because what Augustine would persuade us of, coming straight out of the Bible, is that you and I must not strive for a gift that only God can give. Well, how do I know I'm going to get it? Augustine goes, the reason you can be confident that you will get the future God has is because Jesus ain't dead no more. The resurrection of Jesus, being the first fruits of the resurrection, is the guarantee that you will have the future that you've always longed for, even if you never knew where it was going to come from. Here's the problem. Isn't that falling for the post-human trap of fairness? Do we all have to become the same in the life to come? Augustine didn't only think a lot about resurrection, he also thought about the interestingness of being human. He talked a lot about what he called monstrous bodies. And that's the translation from the Latin. It's not nearly as harsh in Latin as it is in English. The late Roman Empire was not kind to those who were disabled in mind and or body. Those who survived, and not many of them did, were treated like human spectacles, sold and exhibited like circus animals. Some have wrongly criticized Augustine for arguing for perfected human bodies in the resurrection. They posit that such arguments leave us unacceptable or unable to accept the frail human bodies that we have now that are significantly limited. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. He was, to his own credit, just like speculating. He's like, I don't exactly know what these bodies are going to be like. He was doing so for the sake of a congregation, and he himself was a rather limited human being. He had a couple very close calls with death and dealt as a public speaker, a professional public speaker before he became a Christian, and then as a Christian, somebody who was known around the world as one of the greatest preachers of his time, still today one of the greatest preachers who's ever existed, and that man dealt with a horrifically chronic, debilitating, and worsening lung condition. Can you imagine? By the time he was near death, he could barely breathe. So he's not speculating from a place of a perfected human body. Augustine, like the rest of us, had very little of an idea of how it was all going to work out in the end, especially regarding our bodies. But his main premise is that whatever our bodies are, they will be perfect in the sense of being all that they need to be in order to enjoy the utopian paradise of God's gracious new creation. Whatever that is, that's what they're going to be. Fascinatingly, what that means for Augustine is that even somebody's disabilities will not be erased in their resurrected bodies. They'll simply no longer be a hindrance to the experience of eternal happiness. He gets this from Jesus' own words in Luke 21:18. There Jesus says that not a hair from our heads will perish. Here's his question. What in the heck happens to your hair and your fingernails and your toenails in the resurrection? I mean, that's part of you. Those of you who are like into like all those crime shows know that like, that's how they catch them every time. The reason why a stray hair, a fingernail or something can get you caught for murder, whatever else, is because that is an identifiable marker of you. So Augustine goes, well, how is Jesus' command going to be true? And he goes, oh, it's easy. All of what you have ever been will be part of your resurrected body, which sounds gross. You're like, I don't even have much hair anymore. But you're saying all the hair I've ever had will be part of my resurrected body, and all the fingernails and all the toenails that have ever been me, and that kidney that I had and the gallbladder I had taken out, right? That all that stuff I shaved off the back of my heel, all that's going to be me? And Augustine goes, yeah, absolutely. You go, that's kind of gross. How's that going to happen? You want to talk about monstrous bodies? Can you imagine walking around just like a big bag of like fingernails and toenails? He goes, I don't know. I really don't know how it's going to happen. But he goes, imagine what happens when a sculptor takes a metal sculpture and wants to create something new because he just wants to fashion something ideal. He takes all of that thing, however beautiful or however broken that thing is, and melts it down. And all of what it is made into all of what it should be. And he goes, well, I don't know, maybe that's how God's going to do it. But whatever he's going to do, he's not going to erase what you are. He's just going to give you the kind of body necessary in order for the experience of happiness. Interestingly enough, in one place he goes, so maybe that means that if you want to be fat in the resurrection, you can be fat. And if you want to be skinny, you can be skinny in the resurrection. He's like, I don't know. Whatever it is, though, you will not be hindered by the body that you have now in whatever ways you experience being hindered. All we must do is wait patiently for only what God can give in the end, with the sure hope that in Christ we get everything we've ever wanted. So the question is, how can we go about living patiently? Well, the encouragement is to embrace your finitude, friends. Proving through the communal life of this church and the churches that you're a part of, that life lived in a limited fashion is actually pretty great. That in fact, there is a beauty to being born this way. In essence, we live well and we die well. And as we do this, we see technology for what it is, a potential good. To make finite life better, but never perfect. And I know some of you are like, now he's going to show the slide. I'm waiting for the slide. And the slide's going to have the good technologies and the bad technologies. I can have an iPhone 7, but not an iPhone 15. I don't even know. Do they have an iPhone 15? Okay, yes. Ask the nerds up front. Yes, they have iPhones 15. That's the list we all want, right? We're all recovering Pharisees, just give me the list and I should know what technologies. And to do so, I mean, shoot, they're right here. That's what the Amish do. I think there's a good lesson to learn from the Amish. While perhaps, by perhaps I mean absolutely, legalistic in the way that they apply the principles, they do, interestingly enough, pursue the wisdom of communal wisdom when it comes to technology. Their disposition is, this is probably a bad idea. And I think that that is a good way forward. Not that it is a bad idea. And I want to say yes to everything that we can say yes to, but just because it's new doesn't mean it's good. So the thinking isn't, can I or can't I, but should we? Or should we not? Not sin righteousness, but wisdom foolishness. Is this really going to benefit us as human beings? Instead of, is this going to mess us up? Probably not. Let's go for it and see what happens. This includes everything from IVF to experimental medical procedures, to wearable technology. Friends, my desire this evening is to make your lives more complicated, not less. And by that I mean more complicated in the sense of you're actually going to need friends because making these decisions is incredibly complicated. And let's be honest, you're not that bright. And neither am I. Want to buy a new car? Ask your community group if it's a good idea. And wait and hope and pray that your community group goes, why in the heck would you buy a new car? Instead of, that's great, can I borrow it? Not because buying a car is bad or sinful, but what do you want it for? And you should have a good answer and shouldn't get mad and be like, I can do whatever I want. I mean, you get mad when your six-year-old says that. There's an experimental treatment that might give me 6 more months to live. Of course, it'll also make me go blind. What do I do? That is not a decision you should be making for yourself. That doesn't mean you should have everybody else make the decision for you, but let's get some communal wisdom on the thing. Why would you want to do the thing? Let's pray about the thing. Let's talk about the thing. Friends, living is not easy, and it never will be. And it's only more complicated now than it used to be. But one of the things that Christians can really do in an age like ours is die like we actually believe that Jesus is no longer dead. Let me just ask you, you don't have to respond, but I just want you to, you know, up in your brain cavity, think about this. Do you actually believe in the resurrection? I know you're supposed to. I hope you do. So my encouragement and my challenge to you is live as if what you believe is something you actually believe. And I wish that was like really easy to work out in principle. It's not. But if you don't have that foundation, you've got nothing. It's a good place from which to begin. I don't know if I should do this thing or not. I don't know if I should buy this thing or put this thing in my body or put this thing on my body or use that thing or whatever. But I do believe in the resurrection. And I will not grasp for what only God can give. And when talking to your friends who are Christian or not, who are deeply persuaded to use the gifts of technology and are buying into the persuasive elements transhumanism, before you go, how could you ever do such a thing? Think about that question and answer it for yourself. Well, of course, I understand why that would be good. At least a potential good. I mean, who wants to get sick and die? Who wants to live a life of unfairness? Nobody. And one day we won't have to. But maybe, just maybe, in this instance, we're grasping for what only God can give. To live well, we must take care of others, especially the most vulnerable amongst us. Let's be honest. Those who are very severely limited in mind and body don't have much to offer us by way of utility. But their very inability is a gift to the body of Christ. Because what their existence demonstrates to us and what our presence with them demonstrates is your worth is not based on what you can do. And sometimes the greatest gift that you have is simply being present with everybody else. Sometimes the greatest gift you have is being the opportunity for hospitality, not the one who shows it. And the church doesn't revel only in the people who do, but the people who receive. Because here's the thing. If nobody within our body needs help, then who the heck are we going to help? Somebody's got to be the one who gets helped. So thank the one that you get to serve who can't do very much. You want to turn the world upside down? You want to show that the promises of transhumanism are actually perilous? Serve joyfully those who can't do very much and die right alongside with them like champions. Appreciating whatever it is you are. Lamenting how difficult it is to live in a body. Longing for the resurrection and being sure that it's coming. Many of you may not know of an album titled Red and Blue. Because it was never released. It was recorded by a band named Stephanie. The lead singer, Stephanie, recorded it just a few years before radically changing her name and her music style to become Lady Gaga. To put it mildly, the sounds are quite different. Now, there's nothing wrong in changing one's style or one's tastes. I only bring it up to point towards the challenge of being born this way. It's easy for no one. As much as her gay anthem for the century receives praise and accolations for saying, be exactly who you are. She only wrote it after changing everything about herself in order to become famous. It's easy to bag on Lady Gaga, but let's be honest, you didn't dress like that 5 years ago. It's not easy being human. And all of us live in this consumeristic, persuasive universe full of utopian, almost graspable promises laden with technology. Living in finite bodies will never be easy. It is my prayer that Christians will speak persuasively on the issue of human frailty and live lives that provide a strong argument for living patiently while we wait on an absolutely utopian future that not only God can give, but will give all who wait on Him. Thanks.
All right, we're going to have some questions now. Microphone's going to be down front. We're going to ask you to move the microphone. If you have a question, I'll wait till somebody sits down so you can go ahead and ask them. I'm going to take the liberty to ask one of the first ones. You alluded to it a little bit at the end. You think of transhumanism, if you know anything. What maybe first comes to our mind is something that is more like sci-fi, like Cyborgs.
Yep.
Or something that is just obviously evil to us, like sex robots.
Yep.
It seems like in a room full of Christians on a Sunday night, on a holiday weekend, we'd probably pretty unanimously say, that's a bad idea.
That's a bad idea.
But then you connected it to a variety of other things, reproductive technologies, medical treatments like dialysis. Help us process just for a moment to think about, you know, maybe a couple-step approach of how do we think about that. You're not saying, hey, if you need dialysis, just unanimously say, nope, I'm not doing that.
Right.
I'm gonna die tomorrow.
Yeah.
But how do we approach that? Because there is a level in which we are transcending a providential limitation. Without this treatment, I will not live.
Yep. Yeah, so we talked about this earlier with the interns and some others. Dialysis is a good example. Dialysis is a gift from God. Anybody in here on dialysis? No? Okay. A lot of people are. Everybody clear like what dialysis is? Keeps your kidneys from failing, kind of washes them out. Keeps people alive. People have to go in for these treatments. They're routine treatments, and you can live a long time on dialysis. And it is a way to overcome the limits, because without dialysis, you'd be dead pretty quick. And so something like dialysis is a good thing, but the question for the one going in using dialysis, and this kind of gets to the thing of, like, should you do the thing or not, is like, hey, it's probably a really good idea, but as you're going and getting these treatments, friend on dialysis, you have a gift, and the gift is you're headed towards death quicker than the rest of us. You know that's coming in a way that some of us don't. So know that this is not going to, quote-unquote, save your life in the way that only God can. So know that this is a limited and temporary thing. Long for what God can give and appreciate the God who allows you to use the gift of technology to sustain your life. And seeing that God is sustaining your life, then serve Him. So kind of going like, for what reason am I doing the thing? Are you on dialysis just because you don't want to die? Bad reason to do dialysis. Are you on dialysis because by being on dialysis, you can continue to serve in the nursery and, I don't know, take meals to homeless pets or whatever. Like, whatever the thing is, and you're like, oh, I'm just trying to serve people and live in the world. Great. So it's not actually the thing, but it's the reasons for doing the thing that usually matter. And also, like, in the case of dialysis, it's kind of easy because it's like, okay, well, who else is affected by this thing? The more people who are affected by your decision, the more you can kind of be like, oof, I don't know. Like, dialysis is a pretty easy one. It's just kind of keeping something that's failing from overwhelming your life. But if it's like, well, I just want to be 6 inches taller, so I'm going to have, like, you know, cut the bones, extend the bones, make myself taller. Kind of the question is, like, well, what is that going to do for other people in your congregation, in your community group or whatever, that have other things, it's like, well, you fixed yourself, so why shouldn't I fix myself? Because it's pretty persuasive to go like, wow, you are 6 inches taller. I guess we should all be modifying our bodies to be whatever we can be. But again, these aren't, like, I wish they could say they're easy questions. But these kinds of things of like, not only what are you doing, but why are you doing the thing is sometimes the most helpful way forward.
And then maybe one more, if you have a question, you can go ahead and move down here. It seems that people are either early adopters in technology.
Yeah.
Technology is great. Or the response seems to be often of, okay, technology, transhumanism is bad, technology seems to be bad, so let's all move back to 1930.
Right.
Right. That can't be the answer. We live in 2021.
Yeah.
So what should the Christian's relationship in a sense of like engaging any new technology, whether it's a new app on the phone, a smartphone, a new type of computer, any general parameters that you would say, thinking like how we critically engage?
Yeah. I wish there was like real strong things, but I guess what I would say is one helpful way forward is if you have like a meter, the meter should usually be oriented towards probably not instead of absolutely. Just like, you know, not like we're not Luddites, we're not going back to the 1930s or whatever. I mean, you can if you want, God bless you. There's nothing necessarily sinful about that, but like there are things that are beneficial, and we all realize these things. Even the Amish use stuff, like penicillin. Sure, yeah, it's real helpful. So like we're all engaging in things that are kind of ameliorating the challenges of life. But the disposition should be with something, especially brand new. Like let's at least pump the brakes and be especially considering something that is kind of new and has significant ramifications for the lives that we live.
Name church.
Very tall microphone.
I'm good. I'm Catherine, and I go here. So I'm an oncology nurse.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious, how does this whole conversation relate, like when it's your work environment? So it's not like I'm having to think through a decision for myself.
Right.
But I'm taking care of people who are making their own decisions, and sometimes I might ethically agree with them, and sometimes I might ethically not, but I'm given orders to give everybody their treatment.
Yeah, so everybody needs to pray for people like this, because it's some of the most ethically challenging stuff in the world. At what point, essentially, does she say no, right? At which point do you go like, I'm going to get fired over this one, but like, and that's it's an easy thing for you all to think about because you're not in the room. So to some degree, you are, quote unquote, just doing your job. And to some degree, your job is an incredibly challenging one and a real beneficial one. Spent a lot of time around medical professionals, and one of the challenging things, maybe you face this too, is like the idea of playing God. And like you feel elated when the thing works and absolutely devastated when the thing doesn't work. So I think one of the things that you can do, just kind of generally going to work every day, is just pursuing it with a large dose of humility of being like, maybe this will work, maybe not. I'm going to do the best I can. I got 2 hands in 24 hours, and I cannot save the world. And this is my job, and so I will pursue my job and do what I'm going to do. And at certain points, if it's just like overwhelmingly like, I can't keep doing this, like I'm doing things that I should not be doing, there's always going to be questionable things of like, I don't know if I should be doing this or not. They're asking me to do it. Okay. Find people to talk with about it. But I think for the most part, a lot of the stuff that you get to do is some of the most helpful stuff imaginable, helping people go through the worst part of, for most of them, their lives, kind of dying well. And I think the hard part is there's no playbook, as you know, to like how people should die, when they should die. When does it turn from, treatment into assisted suicide, right? Those kinds of questions of like, are we helping them die? Are we helping them to live? Those are questions that are like really easy for people like me when you're sitting in a room thinking about ethics about. It's really hard when you're like, okay, well, this is the thing I've been given to give this person the thing. I think that, again, if you're starting to realize, oh, wow, I do not want that job. You do not want that job. My daughter actually wants that job. So I thank God for people like you. Serve the people that are put in front of you. do the best you can. And if you're put in positions that you're like, I don't know what to do about this, there's probably a few people in this room that can at least pray with you and hear you out and like talk. But it's one of the most ethically challenging positions in our society. I wish I could give you like really great answers, or if anything, just I'm commiserating with you, because it is super hard.
When describing Daniel Christchurch, when describing the kind of pro-transhumanist position, you use the word fairness a lot.
Yeah.
Why is fairness the highest virtue for these people?
Oh, yeah, because life is really unfair, and unfairness just kind of stinks. And so, you know, everything from we don't get to live the kinds of lives we want to live and could live, or people don't get the opportunities that other people get, and that's unfair. So wouldn't it be great if we could give people the opportunities that other people have? That would be nice. And so it's just kind of this, I think, a general concern for neighbors and being like, well, shoot, man, like, it stinks that you don't have that opportunity. If we could give you that opportunity, we should give you that opportunity. So let's just pursue fairness.
Hi, my name is Mark. I go to Christchurch. So you touched on how Christianity can offer a better eschatology than transhumanism.
Yeah.
Can you touch on how Christianity offers a more compelling anthropology? And to kind of frame the question a little bit, like it seems that the transhumanist, through the pursuit of utopia by means of technology, is pursuing a return to the blessings of Eden by means of the same sin which got us expelled from Eden,
right,
which is like trying to be God through being omniscient, omnipotent, or the ability to have like self-definition.
Yeah. So I think the better anthropology is essentially being like, look, man, this has never gone well for humans when we've tried to do what only God can do. Now, this one way, like the shorthand is like we shouldn't play God. But like we play God all the time. Like I'm sure some of you have taken ibuprofen. Maybe in the last hour, you're like, this is breaking my brain. I can't deal with this. And to some degree, it's like, you know, the fixing of the bummers of the human condition. But there does seem to be a place where it's like, no, I'm going to not like solve this small problem I have, but do something that's beyond my capacity. So think about like humans are created in God's image and given dominion. But God's still God, and humans are not that. Which means, I think, usually when we talk about dominion, we're like, yeah, dominion, like, let's burn all the owls and, you know, drive big trucks or whatever. We're like, dominion. Whereas I think that dominion is actually, ideally, a large dose of humility. Realizing that you're not God, and realizing that you're in a privileged position in God's creation, which means you're also significantly responsible for the place that you are. Given that, you go, humans, the better anthropologists, humans are amazing. The only thing humans aren't is God, so let's not do that thing. But by being these incredibly creative creatures and stuff, like there's all kinds of stuff we can do and should do. And unfortunately, there's not like a playbook on here's all the limits of those things. But it does give us this kind of idea of like, no, humans are great, but humans are actually a thing. Because, again, like whatever post-human is kind of hard to understand if you don't understand what humans are. Like, how are you going to move beyond that, and how is that going to be better if this is the only experience that we have? And Christians, I think, can come along and go like, no, seriously, like this is a bummer and broken, but this is actually like the inclination we have of like, but being human is also kind of great, right? We're like, yeah, it is great. Because we're actually very different than anything else in creation. Because we're created in God's image. Which is just a small part of like how the human anthropology or the Christian anthropology is helpful to those who have these kind of transhumanistic flights of fancy but can't even get down to the level of like, but what is a human? Christians can kind of make some progress there.
Cool. Thank you.
I have an honor. Our Christchurch kids deacon, who I see looking at me, who I thought looked in my direction the last time we went along. We're going to take your question because you're right at the mic. And then I'm going to dismiss if you have additional questions. Jeremy's going to be standing at that time.
Yep.
be able to answer it. Yeah, there might be revival up here, but not necessarily downstairs.
My name's Kurt Mobley. My wife and I are missionaries in Prague, Czech Republic, so our home church is in Prague.
So you get the distance award.
I do.
Yeah, distance
award. I do. We do. So a few years back when I was a working staff, I had a headhunter call me, and he was Catholic, and we got into a discussion about contraception.
Yep.
And he believes there's a lot of cursing or effects because of this. So my question is, what should we Protestants be saying about contraception and marriage and having children? I can give you a quick example on the mission field. A married couple without children mentioned to another missionary that they didn't have children, and the other missionary said, oh, well, when are you going to start? Because that should be what you're doing.
Yeah.
And they were so offended. And I said, well, it really, and the person came to me and I said, I think you need to look in your theology.
Yeah.
So well, that's my question.
I just want to thank you for having us end on an easy one. Not a controversial one. If you can't get comfortable with life as you currently experience it, I think you're going to have a very hard time being a Christian. I will not be fully human until I have children. Ask the people in here holding babies in the back if they feel fully human. Like, no, this thing's sucking the life out of me. Children are a blessing from the Lord. Contraception, all the procedures that allow us to pursue the procreative benefits of being human are amazing. They're amazingly powerful, which means they're amazingly complicated. All powerful things are. All I'll say is this, you got to get comfortable with not having what you want in life. If you can start from that position, then you can start to think rationally. If you can't, you're going to do anything it takes to get the world you want. And you've become a transhumanist. If you can work from a place of contentment, then you can kind of then ask the question, well, what kind of world should I pursue? Like, I don't know if you figured this out yet or not, for some of you parents, sorry, birds and the bees stuff, right? Sex ordinarily is oriented towards the procreation of children. It's just the way it works. But it doesn't work that way all the time. So, in the use of contraception, you should understand what you're doing. In the use of fertility technologies, you should understand what you're doing. And in both cases, you should be willing to embrace the life that you currently have, come what may. If you can't start from that position, you're hosed. Now, that doesn't exactly answer all the questions of rightness or wrongness, this, that, or the other thing. But I do think that kind of a blanket place to begin, so that the children don't riot downstairs, is simply this. Come to a firm position that the way that you are right now and the way the world is right now is exactly the way that God wants the world to be, because he's in charge and this is the way the world is. That doesn't mean you don't work towards something else. That doesn't mean that you don't help others and love others. But it does mean that God knows what he's doing even if we don't. And that God is going to fix everything in his good time, which allows us to be humble, patient, and to the best of our ability, content with the world as it is now. And from that position, then think, now how should I live today? There you go.
To Kurt's question, at least what you said with the interns, maybe flesh out a little bit.
Yep.
The way you would answer that for one person,
yeah,
and the way that you'd answer that for another person, almost similar or it's the same variables,
yep,
could be different. Where one person would be sinning using contraception,
sure,
and another person you would say, hey, this is actually a reasonable conclusion. The same for reproductive technologies, how you might reason there. So what we want are blanket answers, buckets.
Right.
But the reasoning is more important than the
outcome. The reasoning. So, for example, like, I couldn't survive if I had children. That is not a reason to use contraception, right? There are 1,000 reasons on the pro side why you might, 1,000 reasons on the bad side, but it's all your disposition towards the thing, how you'd be going about it.
I can't live without children.
So I'll do whatever it takes. Yeah. Yep. Yep.